Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we seek to recover faith by recovering the faith. And we've been doing this for a while now. Mm-hmm. And in recent months, we've been discussing Nathan's book, Essential Faith.
Right.
Which is a book about, as you might guess, faith.
Faith.
And we're coming toward the end. We're focusing on four exhortations that Nathan gives at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. Last time we discussed evangelize, don't proselytize. This week we discuss retool discipleship. All right. Now wonder what he might mean. Is this a play on words?
Right.
Having to do with tools?
I guess so, yes.
Does discipleship involve tools? And so there's tools that we use, we have a tendency to use, that we're mm-hmm. used, we're accustomed to using in discipleship. And maybe you're suggesting that we get some different tools?
Yes. Yes, a different. So I think there's pretty much one tool that we use and then a lot of tools based on that tool. And I'm thinking that there's another tool that's mentioned in that tool.
Mm. Now, Nathan, don't be a tool.
Too late. Yep.
All right. So the one tool that we have a tendency to use is the Bible. Mm-hmm. I know Nathan. I know what he has to say.
Yes,
so
of course.
I know I'm cheating. It's mm-hmm. not fair. And then you're saying there's a tool inside that tool that is really the tool.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, let's talk about all this. Let's talk about the problem mm-hmm. first.
Okay.
What's the problem with discipleship as it's currently practiced?
It's difficult. It doesn't seem to work very well.
Okay.
I don't know. As somebody that's worked in church ministry and specifically in ministry to children, a lot has been done in terms of how do you get somebody not only to learn the details, I guess, the facts, but to live that out, you know? And I guess that's what discipleship is, right? So we would say that Christian education would be you're passing on information, you're catechizing, and then discipleship would be something that you do to get somebody to do something with that knowledge. So in churches, you've got at least as much history with this as I do. What's your experience been?
So you're suggesting that there's Christian education and then there's discipleship. Maybe this is not your view, but this is how it's practiced. You're mm-hmm. trying to maybe give like an introduction to the topic.
Yeah.
And there's teaching, quote unquote, the faith in an educational sense, like mm-hmm. in instructional, informational sense.
Yeah.
And then there's discipling people, which is maybe somehow moving them to put that into practice, making it their own and mm-hmm. living out the implications.
Now, certainly one's related to the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, mm-hmm. you can't. In our thinking, at least, and probably in reality, you can't have one without the other, I would think.
Yeah, and Christians today, whenever they say they're getting serious about discipleship, whenever they describe this church or that church as being serious about discipleship, and of course, that's what they mean. They're talking about, like, we don't want to just be cultural Christians, nominal Christians. We don't want another generation of Christians in name only. We're seeking to really follow Jesus. Live it out.
Yes. Yeah. So, I guess, and we've talked about Saddleback and their model, which is intended to move people through levels of commitment. Mm-hmm. But, it's in the context of the church. And so the church becomes, I guess, another tool of discipleship, a method to disciple people, right? So there's accountability. There's those kinds of things in a community. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we say discipleship, what we mean is a one-on-one relationship with accountability. Nowadays, maybe it's becoming called a spiritual director or something like that. Maybe those are somewhat related. But you've got somebody who is prescribing something, I guess, whether that's giving you an assignment to read or whatever, and then checking in on you. So very much like what you might do in some sort of a training program secularly. How do we train people in the secular world? Now, in the secular world that, say, in the workplace, hopefully we're a little bit, well, not hopefully. I think just historically we're a little better at training in the workplace than we are in the church. I remember one of the, voices that has done a lot of work on discipleship. What it is group publishing and the folks behind that organization. They publish a lot of curricula that have to do with Christian education, discipleship. And group really began as, I guess what they were was like, it was almost like vacation Bible school, but for work. I guess he would just go for a week and do some work project or something, you know, and that was their method.
This was like for adults, VBS for adults, is that what you mean?
Well, it was for teenagers.
Teenagers,
okay. Youth groups would go and just engage in some kind of physical work,
okay,
as discipleship. So there's some attempt to get people to practice their faith, and they were, as they would write about curriculum and stuff like that, I remember an illustration that was talking about if you were training a new secretary in your office, you know, and you gave her a word jumble that had typewriter and, you know, pencil and memo in it, mm-hmm. and you'd think she'd be a better secretary, you mm-hmm. know. And so they kind of equated discipleship to training somebody to do a job mm-hmm. In that illustration. Is it that, you know, is that how we do it? And I think group publishing came more out of one of the mainline denominations, High Church, probably Methodist. But at any rate, that a lot of times those denominations that practice things like, you know, child infant baptism, things like that, they do a lot more in terms of child Christian education, I think, than a group like the Baptist Church or something where we're counting on this big defining conversion moment. So for Methodists and Presbyterians and others that would have you'd have somebody that would be considered a Christian as they're being raised, and they'd have confirmation after they've gone through, you know, a certain level of religious training, you know. And that's realistic, I think. You know, there are people who are growing up in the faith. Hopefully, if we do a good job, they're not going to get into drug addiction and promiscuity. You know, their faith story is not going to include some dramatic change as we would think of it. So it's good that they do that. But I wonder how much actual Christianity gets conveyed. And I know that seems probably uncharitable, but I'm just trying to be realistic. I don't think that we're in a place where we can rest on our laurels and defend what has been historically as a church, as a movement in the United States today. We really have to ask hard questions and begin to lead those sacred cows out into the open and, you know, at least sharpen up our knives, be ready to do what needs to be done wherever we find something that's not helpful, but may just be here by, you know, attrition or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's my hope, is that in light of what I've said in the book about the gospel and its primacy over scripture, and our engagement with it, that we're going to see a movement of disciples that are more like Christ, you know, where the expectation is that people are going to live this out in a way that is uniquely Christian, you know, because I think sometimes we equate Christianity with the wrong thing, with the wrong outcomes. And then when somebody's life looks a certain way, we identify that as Christian when it really may not be Christian at all. It may be something maybe even hostile to the Christian message. And we didn't know it, which is the scariest thing of all. I don't know.
I mean, like Christian nationalism today is like the obvious example to my mind, mm-hmm. right? Like people going around trying to retake the country for God
right.
through political means. And many people might say, well, there go the Christians.
Yeah.
And this is, I feel like I'm one of them and I should be one of them because mm-hmm. I want to be faithful and do my part.
Yeah.
And that's understood to be by some as our Christian duty.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, and just moralism in general has tended to really be more Pharisaic than Christian. Mm-hmm. I mean, throughout history, it's been the Christians who've, say, advocated for the prohibition, temperance movement, you know, all of the moral majority stuff in the 70s and 80s, the religious right in the 90s and the 2000s, all kind of share in common, at least what I see, as an attempt to force society, frankly, to make us comfortable or to facilitate the preservation of our ideals and to nurture our children, mm-hmm. you know, because mm-hmm. heaven forbid, you know, that our children would be exposed to things that we disagree with or are offended by or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Did you mention abolition in that list as well? Did you go all the way back?
Abolition.
You listed some things that Christians have been involved in, and I sure. thought, wait, did he start with abolition?
No, because the Christian movement was on both sides of that debate now. Mm-hmm. In the UK, I think, and Wilberforce is famously, I think, an example of somebody who's applying Christian belief to his role as a politician. But in America, we had... You know, the South is kind of the home of Christianity, right? And the Bible Belt and everything. I mean, there were at least as many essays written in defense of mm-hmm. slavery from a Christian perspective that, yeah. as there were those who might have been against it. Mm-hmm. So, and in America, we tend to solve our problems with at the end of a musket or rifle rather than through protracted debate and, you know, high financial investment. As they did in England. So I don't think in America, at least in the United States, that abolition is an example of Christianity winning out. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that Abraham Lincoln was a Christian proper. You know, if we see him as kind of the spearhead of our abolitionist movement, and yet he's somebody who has a more natural religion, I mm-hmm. guess, less dogmatic, less orthodox, mm-hmm. at least in his writings. So, whereas you had deeply religious people on the, in the South, mm-hmm. overtly religious, like Stonewall Jackson, for mm-hmm. instance, mm-hmm. Who would have, and I don't think they were taking up arms just to defend the right to keep slaves, but at, you know, in the balance, had they won, slavery may have endured several more decades. I don't think that it would have continued on indefinitely, of course, but it would have. There would have been people who had died slaves who didn't otherwise. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If the South had won. So that's just the truth of the matter. However, we understand that conflict. So I don't see abolition as an example of somebody trying to force somebody else to be a Christian. It seems like it. Probably was going the other direction. If you had the majority of all Orthodox Christians or Protestants, let's say, in the U.S. were to vote whether to free the slaves in 1860, mm-hmm. slavery would have continued. So that seems to be the case now. We could go back. I mean, it'd probably be difficult to prove or disprove that, but it does seem to be. Just given the demographics and who had slaves, et cetera. So at any rate, yeah, I don't think that's necessarily, but it would have been good. I mean, even with Wilberforce, I don't think that it's a matter of, and here's where it gets problematic is that the abolition wasn't so much, and I think that to maybe a similar degree, the abortion debate is similar. That that's an example of somebody who has an informed worldview, a Christian informed worldview, who is not looking to defend their own comfort or well-being, but is looking to defend the well-being of the voiceless and marginalized, based on a Christian worldview, but not, and this is where it's a very fine line, not predicated on the attempt to legislate Christianity into the surrounding culture. So if we say abortion, God hates abortion and he's against it and we should make it illegal because the Bible says this and this, that's wrong in my view. If we say human life is important, when our society begins to see humans as liabilities, expendable, recklessly, let's say, without at least considering the possibility that they deserve to be here, then our society's in danger. Now, because I'm a Christian, I see that life is valuable. Now, there may be other worldviews that would say that, but because I'm a Christian, I see that, and I say, well, I don't agree, and I don't think that that's something that we should do, and I will oppose this, and I will advocate for the kind of care for, you know, prenatal care, other things, try to look at the causes why someone would want to get rid of their infant, you know, or whatever, how we define life and all of these other things. It's a complicated matter, but I'm saying someone can advocate against abortion or for, you know, pro-life, whatever they wanted to call it. I mean, in the balance, politically, we're just saying there are people who are in favor of open access to abortion and there are people who are against it. It's really not about when we use rhetoric like pro-life or whatever, what we're assuming is somebody's anti-life. I've yet to meet anybody who's anti-life. So that's not fair. And as an example of probably an un-Christian way to do a Christian thing. Mm-hmm. And again, that gets back to when someone is not informed by the gospel, when someone gets trained in the do's and don'ts of moralism, and don't cast your opponent as evil, doesn't show up on their list of don'ts, they don't have the resources to evaluate what they're doing, and you know, they begin to play the same political game, they begin to see the other person as their enemy. And there we get an un-Christian approach to something that might have begun with a Christian drive, you know. So maybe that make that illustrates it probably as good as anything I might have planned to say today. Is where discipleship has failed. Where moralism fails, which moralism and discipleship are pretty much indiscernible or indistinguishable as far as I can tell. I don't know. You push back on me, you know, tell me I'm wrong, man.
Well, you're saying what discipleship isn't is you know, teaching people and young people in particular to observe a prescribed list of morals.
Right.
And you had mentioned that the tool in this model is the Bible. So we use the Bible wrongly, I think you're going to say, is that we're looking to the Bible for our morals.
Right.
Rather than something else, which is what I think you're getting at. Mm-hmm. It's a way of using the Bible. It's a way of interpreting the Bible. Mm-hmm. What does the Bible say? What is it for? And in moralistic discipleship, the Bible is like a rule book. So it's a book of morals.
Mm-hmm. Right. So here's an example of moralism entering Christian curriculum. Okay, when I was leading the kids ministry and using the curriculum produced by group, as I mentioned, and you know, I think they've made some good observations and even some good recommendations out there, but their curriculum was still, at the end of the day, a product, as is youth ministry. And when you have a product, the only thing that matters is anybody buying? You know, there's really no point in having a product that nobody wants to buy. So you have to be aware of your market. And in truth, youth ministry is successful, that is sought after by parents who want good kids. Sorry, that's how it is, you know. And we think, well, Christianity historically has been something that has had this intention, this aim to make people moral or good. And I want my child to be moral. I don't want them to suffer the ills of falling in with the wrong crowd, etc. Okay. I want my, and if I'm really prudent, I know that that's going to begin when they're very young, a bit more gullible maybe or whatever, right? So I'm going to send them to Sunday school, youth group, etc. Now, as the consumer, the one who's paying the bills, I want that youth group to, whatever else they do, and they may do some wonderful things, But I also want my child to be good. You know, I want my child to, for instance, tell me the truth. And to have an internal compass so that I can trust them and I'm not always having to watch them, you know. Now, so as you go into the Bible and you make the case, and I think something that shows up on most lists of morals in most societies around the world is tell the truth. With sometimes that's a more of a guideline, sometimes it's critical, but tell the truth is generally better than tell lies most of the time. It's very difficult to make the case from the balance of the Bible. If you were to take Genesis through Revelation, it's very difficult to make the case that telling lies is always wrong all the time. Okay? But that's not very good child parenting. You know, if you say, well, Timmy, only lie if it's really going to get you out of trouble or it's going to, you know, whatever. Like, it's very hard to give somebody guidelines for proper deceit.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I mean, there's the story about Rahab, right? She lied to protect the spies. So, like, that's an example of what you're talking about. And there's maybe a moral implication there. But you're saying that just gets complicated. We like to keep it simple. Is that what you mean?
Well, we need to keep it simple. We can't tell young people that lies are sometimes okay. You can't, you know, you can't tell your three-year-old that lie was a bad lie and this lie is a good lie. How can we do that, right? Or how can you tell anybody that, you know? It's very difficult to trust that someone will have the resources to lie appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you say, well, lie, but only for a good reason. Now you've left them to decide where they've got a good reason. You know, it's like, look, tell me the truth and I'll decide whether you've got a good reason to not tell anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but don't keep it from me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you're looking at a list of outcomes, let's say you're producing a curriculum, a Sunday school curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're good at your job, you're asking, what do you want these people to become?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're doing the discipleship remotely, really, through several layers of other people as writing a curriculum. And you want to know what outcomes in life. You want them to know something, you want them to feel something, and you want them to do something. If you're holistically addressing a human being, that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so you're writing this curriculum, and you put this list together. What would you want this person to be and do? You know, truthful, probably, you know, that's going to show up on the list. Now, the problem is that you're also teaching the Bible. But the Bible doesn't have an unambiguous condemnation of lying. I would say that the gospel does, or at least the gospel gives us a resources for proper deceit when needed. Mm-hmm. You know, and we could talk about that. But how do you help somebody with that? Okay, so I remember just distinctly that there was we were in the story of Jacob and Esau, and it's a story about when Jacob goes in, he's wearing the goat skins, you know, and his father's blind. He says, "I'm Esau," and all that. And the moral point to the story was we shouldn't lie.
Okay. Right.
Do you get that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you hear that story, what you get is don't lie, right? Everybody sees it so obvious that lying is bad in that story. What?
In the story, lying works.
It's good. I mean, and not only does Jacob get the better of Esau, he's God's chosen man. He's the one that the line goes through. God's endorsed him. You know, the elder will serve the younger since before he was born.
Yeah.
So here's this awful, awful person. You know, I mean, I would not want to meet Jacob. And if I did, it would only be to, you know, whap him upside the head, although he'd probably kick my butt since he whipped, you know, he did pretty good against the angel when he was pretty advanced in years, past middle age probably. So yeah, he'd probably tear me up. But at any rate, you know, he's not the kind of person that you'd want to hang out with. He's a mama's boy. You know, he's deceitful, liar, self-interested, right? Just the worst. He's just the worst. And he's the guy, right? So what is that story actually teaching us? You know, if you were, if you had to teach that story to little children, what would be the moral message? You know? What? Lie only as if mom helps you. You know, lie only to people who can't figure it out. Make sure that the other person is really gullible, you know. Be have an escape plan when your lies are discovered. You know, what are the takeaways from that story morally, right? So that's the difficulty that that comes when we try to turn the Bible into a moral handbook, basic instructions before leaving Earth. Now, if I say to my child, look, I'm your dad. I don't want you to lie to me. You're safe. If you come to me and tell me the truth, you know, you may have a consequence or something, but it won't be as bad as if I discover it later. You know, this has nothing to do with your faith. This is you as my child, and I'm telling you, don't do that, or I will punish you, right? That's just purely what I don't want them to do, and I need to be honest about it, you know, and say, look, your job right now is to obey me, and that's how it works around here. Now, as they grow, they ought to be able to begin to transition, like with Israel, and they have the bar mitzvah, right? So you become a son of the law. Before that, you were a son of your dad, you know? When you're a son of the law, now you're responsible to what the law says. And potentially, I mean, if we roll this back far enough, I don't know how long this was a tradition in Israel, but does that mean that after 13, you're subject to all that stuff about capital punishment for despising your parents? You know, is that why? That was like, well, okay, we can't take out a five-year-old, you know, or whatever. At what point is this person responsible to this prescription? Because that's severe, right? The law is much more stern parent than your dad, right? So anyway, when we use the Bible to do that, what we've taught that child by using that story to teach it is wrong to lie, we've taught that child a few things. One, we've probably not stopped them from lying at all, so we haven't accomplished our actual goal, but we did teach them that the Bible can be bent and twisted to say what church people want it to say. We've made that point very clear, at least to an aware child, somebody who's actually paying attention, you know, that the Bible doesn't necessarily have its own message, but it consists of a bunch of malleable anecdotes that can be updated and misapplied as needed. That's what we've taught the child, really. That's the meta message behind that lesson. So how do we help people have the resources to live this out? You know, I don't think that Jesus meant to give us the Bible as a discipling tool. Now, he came to people who had Bibles, or at least had access to hearing the law, right? I'm sure they didn't all have copies of Bibles. But they knew the law. And so if you're preaching to people who are somewhat scholarly or at least all know the same book, you know, how do you relate to them? How do you convey a message to them? What is it you're trying to say? Because the people who you're teaching have become terrible people, you know? Like, there's not a whole lot of positive about the Pharisees in Scripture or in popular concept. We don't think of them as mostly good and misunderstood. We just think of them as bad people, you know? Bad in all the wrong ways, and yet simultaneously religious and biblically literate. So, and the last thing any of us would want to be is a Pharisee, and yet somehow, I'm sure the Pharisees didn't set out to be hypocrites either. So how do we do this? So Jesus comes and he's not offering another rule book. He doesn't seem to ever attempt that. He's telling stories, right? He's going around, he's doing things. What he does do is he invites people to follow him, which wasn't uncommon, you know, but he sees discipleship as an apprenticeship program, an on-the-job training, and not enrolling in a school as he's walking around. Now, his attempts at discipling these 12 guys, or however many ultimately it ends up being, I think fall flat. I don't think it's very successful at all at the end of his life. I don't think that these guys are much more like him than they were when they started following him. And it's not too surprising to him. And I don't think it's too surprising to God. What do you think went wrong when you look at it? I mean, because honestly, I think we romanticize that white hot period in history. If I were to ask, you know, say a bunch of just serious, the most serious kids in the youth and young adult ministry, right? People who've been, they've been on mission trips, right? They're leading in some sort of a capacity in their church. And I were to say, you know, if you could give up the next 3.5 years of your life to walk with Jesus on the earth, you know, and then come back after that. I'm going to take you on a mission trip into history.
Mm-hmm.
How many of them would say, you know, that just doesn't, I don't know. I'm crapping in the woods. That doesn't sound fun, you know. And what do they eat over there again? It's just like, I'm gluten intolerant. I don't know if I could make it, you know. I mean, how many of them would be like, do they have iPads, you know? I would think most would say yes, right?
Yeah,
maybe even so. I would. Yeah, I mean, I would certainly want to meet the person Jesus of Nazareth, and so I can't fault anybody for that. And we see that as probably a superior experience in our heart of hearts. If people are just really honest with themselves, like, would you trade places with Peter? You know, Christians, serious Christians today. You know, would you trade places with him permanently? You know, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think, is there anybody out there who's like, man, I'm glad I'm on this side of it. And I would not want to be walking with Jesus at that time because they were missing out on so much that we have.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, I'm cheating because I know the answer, but I think probably people don't have the resources, the understanding to answer the question, to give the right answer there. Yeah. Probably we'd have romanticized the historical person, Jesus, the experience that was had in the Gospels, such that people would think of that as the ideal, to be able to be there for that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. It's difficult to judge other people. You know, all I really know is my own heart, and I know what I was like, you know. So when you read stuff in the Gospels where Jesus says, it's better for you that I go away, and you're like, is it? You know, but if it is better, if what he was saying there in John 14 through 16 is true, then our experience is superior to theirs. Wait, that has to follow, right? But how many people really would long to be there, you know? I mean, Jesus of Nazareth, the whole story is very compelling. It was to me, it is to me. And yet when people take the Gospels and they say, okay, you're right, Nathan. It's not just about memorizing Bible verses. It's about being like Jesus. So just red letters, you know, we're just going to go red letter Christians. And it's like, no, you know, it's like, that's not what I'm saying. But the idea is that if I read about his life in the Gospels and I try to broad brush you know, imitate him. Okay. He didn't have material wealth. Okay. So I'm going to get rid of my stuff. Maybe that's a good idea for people. But doing it to mimic Jesus of Nazareth does not make somebody more like Christ. Mm-hmm. It really kind of makes them a judgmental jerk. And we can't generalize that approach to life because there were a lot of early Christians who didn't do that. You know, we talked maybe last time about Zinzendorf. You know, here's somebody who's very wealthy, continued to be very wealthy, but also open with his wealth, also mm-hmm. facilitating the church mightily, generously, but somebody who continued to be a count, someone who continued to own an estate. He didn't just go the full St. Francis, right? So here's Francis. He's a guy who decides to follow Jesus of Nazareth. And hey, I'm a big fan. I'm a fan of Francis. Now, if everybody tried to be Francis, where would the church be, right? We just wouldn't be able to survive, I don't think, as a movement. And it doesn't seem to be... Francis himself, I think, was kind of a tortured soul. I think he was always chasing a Christ-likeness that eluded him to the point that, you know, there's only so much you can divest yourself of. Once you just have a robe, right, and you're just walking around, the only thing you have left is the robe, right? And really, at the end of his life, he just took off his robe, laid naked on the ground, and died. You know, I mean, the guy just... If your Christianity consists of how much you've given up, right, you begin to accrue some sort of merit in your own mind and heart. I don't know if that was true of Francis, but all that to say is that it's a very dangerous approach sometimes to set as the expectation that people would be like the guy in the Gospels. And honestly, it did not make those people better. Those guys had that opportunity. So following Jesus doesn't necessarily... Now, when Jesus invited these guys to follow him, he's literally saying, follow me, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But literally following Jesus had, it seems, little to no benefit on them in terms of spiritual quality. The salvation of their soul, if I can use that terminology. You know, when we talk about someone's... And I think that the goal of discipleship, maybe that's a way to frame it, is the salvation of the human soul.
And by salvation, you mean it in the sense that you've used it in the book, like real deliverance from the power of sin, real transformation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. So our soul being that will, that part of ourself that's uniquely ours, something that sits between our bodies and the spirit, right? Something that is... the non-material side of a human that we see, their personality, everything, that's really them, really, really them. And most of the time, people have built so many layers between their real identity and what the world sees that we really almost never recognize someone's true self out there in the world. But, and I think that the gospel and that the intention of all of this is the rescue of that unique creation of God that is not the flesh, not the physical self, and not necessarily the spirit. You know, the spirit is the spirit of the human, I think, is something that's made to interface with the spirit of God, etc., right? But I think that the soul is this part that's uniquely me that everybody has, but this part that's being distorted and given away and inhibited and other things by the processes of life. Okay, so if discipleship is the rescue of this person, somebody who can stand with all that dignity of the image of God, then Jesus' protocol, his educating of these guys, did not work out. You know, and so. That's a problem when we think, well, what we need to do is try to imitate Jesus. So learning the Bible is as likely to make you a Pharisee as not. I'm not saying we shouldn't learn the Bible, but I'm saying that we have overemphasized it. We've gotten to the place where it's not sometimes not helpful.
And I think another thing you're saying is that it's important what we learn when we learn the Bible. Like, it's important how we approach the Bible, interpret the Bible.
Yes.
Right?
Right, right. So let's go back to Jacob and Esau, right? There's a wonderful story in there's a wonderful application of the whole Jacob cycle, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The larger context.
The larger context does discourage deceit, you know? So here's somebody who's successful in deceiving other people, but God embraces this individual literally, I guess, if you think about it, and through this contest, this wrestling match, you've got this depiction of what somebody's going out to do when they deceive another.
Mm-hmm.
We are attempting to best that person. Mm-hmm. We are in a competition with them for our own well-being. Mm-hmm. You know, Alinsky talked about Saul Alinsky, who, we could talk about him a lot. But anyway, I think he shaped a lot of political thought in the United States since the 1960s and 70s. And he says you can't avoid corruption. Corruption's here all the time. Corruption begins when the first time a child attempts to play his father off against his mother or something like that, right? So there's this where what the Bible would say is that, you know, hey, this is a sign of the fall. Alinsky's saying, hey, this is just normal. Let's embrace it and do it well, you know? So I probably not the best advice, but all that to say is that he's right, you know, that we are trying to get the better of somebody. So I want my agenda and not yours, even as a small child. Now, little children are going to tell a lie, or they're going to throw a fit or whatever. I'm trying to use whatever power I have, and that may include, you know, my intellect and how clever I can be. It may include my emotional intelligence. It may include just how loud and shrill my voice can be, whatever power I have, I'm using to win against somebody else. It could just be my parent, you know, later it's classmates, teachers, others that may be perceived as in competition or authority over me. And so I have to win, and that's life, right? So Jacob was particularly, even from the womb, bent in that direction, right? So there's... he's named Jacob, which means supplanter or deceiver, which is not a great thing to name your kid. So sorry, all you Jakes out there. Anyway, but he's born holding on to his brother's heel, which is indicative of kind of who he is really from the womb, right? And that he is always trying to best somebody. And apparently he came by it honestly because his mother's complicit in a lot of these machinations. And so here's somebody who's trying to win. Now, when he gets to Paddan Aram or northwestern Mesopotamia, he encounters his equal. Because remember, you know, Laban is his mother's brother. And apparently, these tendencies run in the family. And everybody wants to do something like this. I mean, Esau, while being less shrewd, would use his physical prowess, his strength, or whatever, right? So, yeah, he's bested by Jacob in a manipulative sense, but he's coercive. So he's going to win by just eliminating Jacob, you know, and that's his plan. Everybody's in competition. So when you got somebody who's in that mode, I'm just, this is an aside, and I apologize. So I'm just going to give you the gospel interpretation of the Jacob cycle. Mm-hmm. And how it relates to living our lives. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I gave you a bad way to use it.
Yeah.
Here's what I think is the way. I'm not going to call it the good way. I'm just going to say it's my way. Okay. So when I see the story of Jacob, I see somebody who is good at lying. And not only someone who is good at defeating other people, someone who sees every encounter as a way to negotiate at least. Right, there's something at stake in every encounter that Jacob has, even when he encounters God at Bethel, and he says, "If you'll take me on this journey and bring me safely back, I'll build it." You know, what do you want? You know, I know you want something. How can I? You know, how can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's just how his immediate instinct. He has this, you know, just incredible transcendent moment, and he's already making a deal. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you help somebody who's bent that way, whose every instinct, and at least their first instinct, is how do I get what I want here? You know, and so he encounters Laban. Laban deceives him, you know, and everything. He gets a taste of his own medicine. But at the end of the day, God is with Jacob. He's had this favor over him, and he makes out pretty well. And even though he has to flee with his family in the middle of the night from Laban's house, he's taken a lot with him. You know, he's taken all his flocks and herds and his family, basically a clan, you know, a whole group of people with him. So how do you help somebody like that? How do you save them when they've done this and it's worked out? You know, it's one thing when somebody's attempted it and it's failed miserably, but here's somebody that it's worked. Well, God finds him at a low point, you know, because on his way back, everything's catching up to him. He's in this squeeze chute, really, because here he is at this one little area called Mahanaim. Two camps. And he's stuck between two camps. Laban's behind him. He's already made an agreement. He's not going to go back that way. They mounted up stones and everything. Okay. Esau is ahead of him. He's heard Esau is coming to meet him. Oh, how nice. With 400 men. Uh-oh. Right? Because the last
This is the brother he stole the birthright from.
Right. And who had swore to kill him. Mm-hmm. So he's coming back, and now he's coming with 400 men. So now Jacob is stuck. He is trying to mitigate his losses. He kind of breaks up his family into two groups. He sends a procession of gifts to Esau ahead of him. And now he's alone by this little brook. And so he's at a very low point. Now, if you're God, what do you do when your chosen one is really in a bad spot? He's in a strait, you know. Well, you elbow him in the face, you know. And there's this fight that this wrestling match that goes on. And at the end of it all, you know, Jacob won't let go. He's like, oh, you know, I won't let go unless you bless me. I mean, he's been injured by this being that attacks him. And at the end of it, he's declared the winner of this wrestling match. From that point on, what we see in Jacob, and his name has changed, actually, from the deceiver supplanter to the one who struggles with God, right? Israel. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, what we see is that Jacob is not only trying to get the best of some, not trying to get the best of somebody. He's actually pretty magnanimous. He sends all these gifts to Esau, and Esau welcomes him with open arms. And Jacob realizes walking away, because now remember, he's been declared the winner of this wrestling match and the winner of all of the other conflicts that he's had. Okay. But he's the one limping. And then he discovers that his assailant / opponent was God himself. Now, knowing that he's been declared the winner, does that mean that God lost? What do you think?
Well, I know the right answer is that God didn't really lose. Right. God finally got through to him. Mm-hmm. God got through to him by losing?
He didn't lose, really. I mean, he got exactly what mm-hmm. he wanted.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you,
but he let Jacob defeat him.
He did. So I really think that God gave Jacob a new paradigm, and that is the win-win. Most people don't even understand that such a thing could ever exist. We don't bother to wonder if it could. We just think, look, he's going to win or I'm going to win. Sometimes you win some, sometimes you lose some, right? How do you win them all? Well, you win them all by going for the win-win. You know, you don't have to lose some. And I think that with that new understanding, the idea that for him to have his birthright, or, you know, to be the heir, to be under the keeper of the promise, really, didn't mean that Esau had to do without or to suffer. And in fact, we find that Esau's thriving. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's plenty to be had. And that under the reign of a benevolent God, there's plenty of room for everybody to win. And so you have this very gracious encounter between Esau and Jacob, where Esau really stands as kind of God in a way, in that he, and Jesus evokes that image in the prodigal son story. You know, he sees him in the distance, he falls on his neck, kisses him, welcomes him, right? Mm-hmm. There's this familial love that's activated despite the hurts of the past, right? But what both Esau and Jacob say is, I have plenty. I have enough. Mm-hmm. God has been good to me, right? And I have enough. And that is, I think, the conversion moment for Jacob when he quits being the superintendent of his own well-being and discovers that he's with a God that he cannot overcome, he cannot negotiate with, but one that also wants him to win, mm-hmm. you know? Because mm-hmm. his big revelation at Peniel, this brook that means face of God, is I have seen God face to face and he left me alive. That there's this benign intent. You know, he encounters this camp of angels when he gets to Mahanaim. He doesn't go over there. He's just like, this is two camps. I'm over here, you're over there. Let's keep a safe distance between someone who may be stronger than we are, right? Mm-hmm. Let's negotiate with them. Let's find where, you know, how we can do a quid pro quo here. There's an assumed hostility in all of these relationships. What God has shown Jacob through picking a fight with him and declaring him the winner is that there's such a thing as the win-win. And that in God's economy, people don't have to lose, you know? Now, with that knowledge, what occasions for deceit will we find?
Right, right. So now he goes and he doesn't lie.
Right.
Now he doesn't deceive. He gives generously. He does all the Christian things.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's because he's encountered God. Mm-hmm. He's been transformed.
What's ironic about his meeting with Esau is he does lie, but he lies in a way to preserve Esau's ego, integrity, while also not being a burden to Esau. He lies to Esau for Esau's sake, and I think Esau knows he's lying.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, in that exchange, I forgot what it... I know that he did do that, but I don't mm-hmm. remember what he said.
Well, Esau's like, come on home, come back, stay in my household. And he says,
oh,
why,
yeah, I'll
why
follow
would I do
you.
That?
I'll be right you behind
know?
You.
Yeah. And yeah. he says, well, eventually Esau prevails on him because he says, no, that's okay. You know, we don't really want to be a burden or whatever, you know. And he says, no, come on. And so he lets him prevail on him. Mm-hmm. But he says, look, I'm moving with all these children, these flocks. We're slow. Go ahead. I'll catch up. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the lie because he doesn't intend to catch up. He goes instead to Sukkot. Now, that was not for his own sake, I don't believe. I think he certainly eventually wants to be back in his homeland, right? With his, you know, where his estate is. And eventually, I think he is. But at least initially, he defers to Esau. He doesn't try to encroach on him or become his competitor in a way for that region, that territory. Mm-hmm. He almost starts from scratch, moving to a place called Sukkot, right nearby in the land, but starts over in that space. Mm-hmm. And so what we learn from the Jacob story isn't an indictment on individual untruths. So mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But what we do learn from Jacob is how to be an honest person mm-hmm. who may, for the sake of somebody else, tell a white lie. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mean you're a dishonest person. It just means that you love other people. You want to maintain their dignity. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got somebody, let's say they have dementia or whatever, and you're wanting to, and you just play into something, a delusion mm-hmm. that they have, rather than trying to give them this moment
right.
of grief
right.
or whatever. Now, does that mean you are an evil, conniving SOB, or does that mean that you are a loving, generous, magnanimous person.
Because love is the rule.
Right, right. And so that's the message of the Jacob story. It's not that God really endorsed Jacob's way of getting there, but it's that God is working with a flawed person and actually absorbing his flaws in order to, you know, that God has so much grace that he can convert all of our wickedness into his story of redemption and into a new person, you know, somebody who is worth knowing, somebody who deserves to become a patriarch and the namesake of the nation.
So the Jacob story, the Jacob and Esau story in its larger context is a story about the gospel. It's a story about grace. And your point is that the Bible is about grace and not about following the rules.
Right. Yeah.
And when we do interpret the Bible properly, we understand that it offers us a message, the gospel message about grace. And it's that message which makes disciples.
It is. And specifically, and unfortunately we're running out of time, and and specifically, I think that what Jacob encountered there was Jesus. I mean, in my opinion, in my view, and so there's this encounter that is perhaps unpleasant, stressful, may even leave us somewhat disabled, and yet is a moment of divine rescue of. The discovery of his generosity, his intent toward us. And I think that the genius and the reason we're living in an era that is superior to anybody ever, you know, including those 12 that walked with Jesus, that our era is better is because we have access to peniel, that crisis moment, that juncture between God and humankind, between our deepest fears and his great power, that we have that intersection available to us at any moment of any day through the gospel, through the cross and the empty tomb, which is where we're going to go next time, is how that event becomes the discipling method of Christ today, how we end up following him in a way that actually makes us more like him, as opposed to whatever methods we may use to shape somebody's character. He has a method that I think is the only one that retains human agency, well-being, but also aims at changing somebody from within, giving them this onboard ethic so that they can lie faithfully if they have to.
Tell the good lie.
Right, yeah.
That's good. All right, excellent. We'll land there and pick up again next time with the cross. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. If you got questions, you can email us discussion@recoverfaith.org. We'll see you soon.